This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Morning Run. You're here with me, Roshan Kanesan, and Wong Xiaoning. And in about half an hour, we've got the breakfast grill. And today, Lin Mark takes us through some of the most significant conversations we've had about politics on the breakfast grill this year, including interviews that we've had with Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad and Hannah Yeo as well as Syed Saddiq.
Yeah, well, no one can beat the interview with Dr. M, right? That is the BFM coup of the year.
And, moving on, we're taking a look at the 2019 in review. In particular, we're taking a look at the Middle East. The Middle East this year and North Africa was a year of 5 uprisings, 4 ongoing civil wars, and 3 key elections, including the one in Turkey and Israel. It was also a key year of regional developments and international developments, with the US employing its maximum pressure campaign against Iran and the attacks on the Saudi Aramco facility. And this is only among the other stories that have happened in the Middle East this year. To help us digest and get into this, we speak to Professor James Dorsey, Senior Fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies and Middle East Institute in Singapore. Welcome, James. In your view, what were the most important developments in the Middle East in 2019?
I would say there were two things. One is U.S. President Trump's policy towards the Middle East as it has evolved and how that is perceived by different Middle Eastern players, and the attacks in September on 2 key Saudi oil facilities.
And this year, we also saw uprisings in Algeria, Sudan, Lebanon, Iraq, and Iran, which had mixed outcomes. Now, how have these changed the landscape of politics in the region?
Well, I'm not sure. First of all, I'm not sure that they've had mixed outcomes. I think what you've seen is Sudan, where you've had a uprising that actually has changed the system, and now it has a transition government in which the protesters are part or at least represented in that government, and we'll have to see over time how that develops. And you have uprisings in Algeria, in Lebanon, and Iraq, which are ongoing, and in which the fight is still taking place, and where we are at a point at which the demand, you actually have had the leaders of those countries resign, but you don't have an agreement of who is to take their place. And that's a battle taking place. And then you have the protests in Iran, which were not really necessarily to overthrow the regime, but were against specific policies. Nonetheless, those protests in Iran come in the context of a U.S. policy that is designed to force the regime to change its policies. Now, I think underlying all of that is the fact that when you had the popular Arab revolts in 2011 that toppled the governments of Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and Yemen, and subsequently 3 of those revolts being rolled back with a military coup in Egypt and civil wars in Syria and in Yemen, that the perception was the revolts had failed, rather than that this is a process and it's going to take years, and 2011 was just the beginning.
Now, while we're on the topic of change of leadership earlier, there were 2 notable close elections in the region, with the reigns of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appearing to be stuttering to an end. How much longer do you think they can hold out?
Well, I think it's hard to put a timeline on it. In Israel, we'll see what happens in March. That is when Israel holds its 3rd election in a year, because it was unable, as a result of the last 2 elections, to form a government. Israel is also different from Turkey in that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been indicted and will have legal proceedings, and that could hasten his downfall. In Turkey, the situation is that you have a mayor in Istanbul for the first time in many years, who is from the opposition party, is potentially a candidate in the next Turkish election, which is several years down the road, and in the meantime is unveiling what he alleges is mismanagement and corruption in the Istanbul municipality, which is Istanbul, Turkey's most important city, as it was ruled initially by Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan himself, and he was mayor back in the early 1990s, and by the AKP, his political party, since.
Now, let's talk about the Gulf, right? How has geopolitics between Saudi, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Iran changed this year, especially considering the drone attack on the Saudi Aramco plant?
Well, I think what you had, and this goes back to one reason why I think Trump's policy is so fundamental, that in the period from 2011 until the until this year, you had the Saudis and the UAE pursuing a very robust go-it-alone foreign policy that produced a fair number of fiascos, including the Yemen war, including the failed attempt to change the prime minister of Lebanon, and the persecution of dissidents, culminating in the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi more than a year ago, who was killed in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. What changed is two things, I think, this year. One, that the UAE, even before the attacks in September, realized that it was vulnerable and started to reach out to Iran so that if there was a military confrontation with Iran, Iran would not target its facilities. And then the attack in September on the Saudi facilities, to which the United States and Trump specifically reacted, basically saying, it's your problem, and if you want help, you can hire us and pay us to help you, but it's not automatic. And so what you're seeing is a much more multilateral, much more consultative approach on the part of both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. You've seen some contact between Saudi Arabia and Iran. That is stopped at the moment because of the revolts in Iran, sorry, in Lebanon and in Iraq, which the Saudis see as anti-Iran, and they want to see what comes out of that first.
So as the U.S. is taking a step back under Trump's policy, how has U.S.-Saudi relations changed, especially considering the reduced U.S. Dependence on oil from the Middle East?
Well, Saudi Arabia's relationship today is primarily with the White House. Its relations with Congress are very troubled, and they have not improved as a result of the sentencing of several people in Saudi Arabia who were held responsible for the death of Jamal Khashoggi. The trial is perceived as a fig leaf rather than as a transparent process trying to find out what happened, holding those responsible accountable. The relationship with the White House, Trump has gone out of his way to try and protect the Saudis on the one hand politically, but he no longer is perceived by the Saudis as a reliable ally and guarantor of security.
Now, James, Malaysia hosted the KL summit last week, which was attended by leaders of Iran and Turkey, but noticeably snubbed by Saudi Arabia, UAE and Pakistan. What were your impressions of the event, and what does this say about Malaysia's relations with countries in the Middle East?
Well, first of all, I think that you have a split in the Muslim world between, on the one hand, a bloc or countries that are going to fall into line with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and on the other hand, a bloc that is opposed to the Saudis and the Emiratis, in which Turkey and Qatar are main players. Clearly, now, Malaysian-Saudi relations since the return to office of Mahathir Mohamad have not been all that smooth. Malaysia obviously believes that Saudi Arabia was, or the Saudi parties, including the government, were part of the 1MDB scandal. You also have the appointment of a defense minister who has a record of being critical of Saudi Arabia. And you saw the closure of the Saudi-funded center in the Ministry of Defense that was supposed to combat terrorism. So it's not all that much of a surprise that Malaysia hosted a summit that clearly was designed to break Saudi-UAE leadership, or in any case, influence, or counter it. And that, in many ways, is going to determine Malaysia's relationships with various countries in the region.
James, looking forward to 2020, do you expect any regime changes in the Middle East? And which regimes look most vulnerable, I guess, to that?
Well, clearly, you have ongoing battles in Algeria, in Iraq, and in Lebanon, in which protesters have already forced leaders to resign. And the struggle is now for what transition is going to look like and who is going to lead that transition. It's very hard. These are processes that are very hard to predict in terms of which country is next or when will it happen. But fundamentally, most Middle Eastern countries are candidates for this kind of process. And whether that happens in 2020, whether that happens a little bit further down the line, your guess is as good as mine.
Thank you very much, James. And that was Professor James Dorsey, a senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies and the Middle East Institute in Singapore. Up next, we'll be speaking to Faisal Aziz of ABIM on the upcoming Dongzong gathering. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.